Hello, and welcome to Need to Know, your weekly investment podcast brought to you by the experts of Coutts. I'm Sarah Muir, and I'm joined as always by Coutts CIO Alan Higgins. Each week on the podcast, we look at the three things investors need to know. Now, that might be for the week ahead, or we often actually open it out into longer term trends and themes. And also, we make sure that Alan reads research so that you don't have to. But before we get to this week's Need to Know, Alan, a few sort of things to catch up on. We had another upgrade to UK data. Just for those that didn't catch that, what was that? And I mean, when are these upgrades going to stop? We seem to be getting lots of positive news about the UK at the moment.
Yeah, I should say, because we are Coutts, we are more of a global investor than a UK investor, but nevertheless, we live here in the UK. Yeah, the good news keeps coming in about the UK. Before we know it, UK inflation will be 2%. We shall see. We shall see. No. So we had the big upgrades only 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And a bit of a rant about the big upgrades coming. It just struck me how big these GDP numbers were. Okay, 2021, that was hard, went from 7.6 to 8.7.
Okay. But that was the upgrade.
2022, that the upgrade is up to 8.7. Yeah. The 2022 upgrade, 4.1 to 4.3. Okay.
Not so big.
But not so big. But 4.3, Sarah.
Mm.
Guess where interest rates were for most of 2022?
Oh, no. Now you get...
Do you remember when I was ranting?
You were ranting. They were very low.
0 to 1. Okay. So they just had an 8.7% year. Okay, they knew it as a 7.6% year.
Mm.
And now they're in a 4% year. And they spent all that money. And to be fair, not just the UK Central Bank or the Monetary Policy Committee, but also the Fed... Mm. They left rates at zero.
Yeah.
And this is not hindsight, is it, Sarah?
No, it's not.
What was I saying at the time?
You've been saying this for ages, Alan. As long as we've been doing Need to Know, you've been ranting about interest rates.
Thank you. But, you know, in interest of balance, I do get many things wrong, as I will testify and open up to as we go through these. But the ridiculously loose monetary policy, I say, I stand with Larry Summers, who is, you know, on a very prestigious level, basically ranted about it also early. Actually, it's unfair to say he ranted. I think he argued his case very eloquently, whereas I just ranted about it.
So is this it now for upgrades for UK data, or are we going to get some other pleasant surprises?
To be fair, it must be embarrassing for them, the Office of National Statistics, but they continuously look at it. And there was a minor upgrade even this year. So quarter one this year, which didn't feel so great. Do you remember how terrible we felt in quarter one?
We were scratching around for optimistic views on the UK, weren't we?
So now growth looks quite healthy in quarter one. So there you go. They continue to look at it. But anyway, we must press on because we went to the cinema, not together, but on behalf of the show.
We did. But we'll come to that because that's going to be our final point, isn't it? We're going to do a little film review. But also, there was one other thing I wanted to ask you that, because I did mention in the intro that you do the research or read the research that we don't have to. Have you read any interesting research recently, Alan?
So, yes. One from The Economist and two just from the FT. So the one from The Economist is about sizing of positions. It's actually called The Missing Billionaires. I've just bought the book from Victor Hargani, and I'm going to reference it because it comes out a lot when we in terms of the film Dumb Money, which we're going to talk about.
Okay, right.
And then in the FT, a really nice bit of nice piece, which on China, which I think we're all very pessimistic about China, and you've heard me be quite pessimistic about China in terms of Chinese equities, at least in terms of corporate governance. But at least there does seem to be a V-shaped recovery in the sense of, if you like, services, continuing the theme of the upgrades to the UK. So what it shows is basically civil aviation, passenger traffic, and railways, which is obviously big in China. They've surpassed 2019 highs.
Okay.
Well, so let's roaring back.
I was going to say, well, that's actually kind of, we're now kind of encroaching into our first point, aren't we, for Need to Know this week, which was we're going to look at some data. And that's one of the things we were going to look at, wasn't it? It was more positive Chinese data.
You can see this is not carefully scripted, can't you? I got excited by something which contradicts my view. So yeah, the three things. Okay, so we'll have a look at the data, including this Chinese thing, this V-shaped recovery in China, which not many people are talking about. Gilts. We want to talk about gilts.
And we do.
We want to, it's almost like a freebie for all our listeners, but you will put a huge disclaimer on it
at the end, but literally disclaimer. A freebie.
Yeah. Why are gilts CGT free?
Yes.
I can tell you, I was involved with it. I might be responsible for it.
You're responsible for CGT exempt
in
gilts.
In a small way. Okay. And then finally, the film Dumb Money.
Yes.
About GameStop investing mainly, but meme investing in general, and the lessons from that. And it comes back to this book on sizing investments.
Yeah. Okay. And also, I'm hoping that you're going to explain in simple terms what a short squeeze is. I kind of know what it is, but I'm hoping that I'm going to get you to give a nice, simple explanation of what a short squeeze is. Okay. Well, that's to come. To look forward to. Let's kick off with the data then. Well, let's look at this positive Chinese data. It is, of course, I believe, it's Golden Week, isn't it? Which is a big festival week in China. And it's being sort of marked by a real uptick in travel within China, isn't it?
It's true. This data, to be fair, is just prior to Golden Week. Okay, so there's an element of that. And if you look at the graph, it is on the FT for subscribers to see it. And probably just like most things, you can Google it and get the data directly. Mm. And what I like about it in China is that data is not always of the highest quality, to be fair. Neither is UK economic data, as we just discussed.
Has been demonstrated, yeah.
But stuff like the monthly passenger traffic and rail in aviation and in the railways, I think that's really, really interesting. And because we had a post-COVID, we had a V-shaped recovery.
Yes.
Okay, we absolutely did. And so I made the error of judgment in thinking, well, it's no different. In fact, it's going to be even more extreme in China because they love their consumption. A V-shaped recovery in China, it didn't happen.
Well, you weren't alone in that, were you? Because lots of people predicted a really strong bounce back in China, didn't they, post-COVID?
True, true. And what seems to be happening is quite interesting because, for example, luxury goods manufacturer LVMH in France, which is it does a huge amount of volume in China, is indicating a slowdown. So there's this subtlety of going on, even in China, of, dare I say, experiences over items.
Yes.
Over stuff, which what we've kind of seen and helps to explain, by the way, the UK GDP, and we've obviously seen it worldwide. I'm seeing an awful lot of Americans around, for example, near where I live in Victoria. So, yeah, quite interesting. So there's that. And the second bit of experience, the Oktoberfest.
Yes. Which I've never
been
to.
Have you?
I lived in Germany for 16 years and I've never been to Oktoberfest. But that's because I lived in the north. I know, it's shocking, isn't it? I lived in the north of Germany. And okay, there are beer festivals all around Germany, but it's very much a Bavarian thing. And and it's also quite touristy as well. So I've never been.
So just reading the article, it's very
What's this got to do with economics and markets?
Because it's strong. Okay,
right.
Above 2019 levels. So it's midway through, so 3.4 million through, 100,000 people more than 2019. And what I'm surprised about, by the way, I'm impressed how they carry those beers. 14.40 euros on a Maffs. What is it?
Mass. It's a Rook. It's called a Rookside S. That it's like a double S, a mass of Pilsner. Yeah.
Obviously, I can't speak German. those things are massive. You've seen, they're predominantly ladies who carry them.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. They come out with fistfuls of them, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I did go many, many years ago. Really, really enjoyed it. And so it's got an interview here. The chief executive at Paulaner, one of Germany's largest breweries, he couldn't get a table for his mates. Absolutely sold out, you know. So signs of despite higher interest rates, signs of strength in the global economy, more focused on services. Just to add, employment week coming. And the various employment reports in the US looking for moderation. I expect it in the UK. Absolutely crucial this time. Wages need to slow. I do expect it.
And of course, because we've got no central bank meetings in October, have we? So focus will shift to early November when we've got the Fed and the Bank of England. As we don't have now a shutdown in the US, because that was going to be, that was a question mark for the Fed, wasn't it? If we had a shutdown in the US, they would have been missing some key data, wouldn't they? They wouldn't have had CPI and they wouldn't have had a jobs report.
Correct. They, you know, imagine that, trying to set monetary policy without data. Maybe it'd be more successful. Going back to my rants of 2019, about 2021 and 2022. But yes, so nevertheless, basically, it remains the case. The employment data and the inflation yeah. data are crucial. Looking for moderation along the way. Seasonally, not a bad time to get involved in equities. Not a recommendation. I should say, we stopped our Michael Burry short selling or being short the market. Ironically, the market is down 7% from the highs. So we are in a bit of a weaker period. But I did always say it felt more like a minus 10%. Correction rather than the big one that maybe he was looking for. So one thing to add, it is backward looking. We'd like to do less backward looking stuff, but just in case you missed it. And the extent of it is interesting. Eurozone inflation down to 4.3%.
Yeah.
Was going in the right direction. Yeah. Was 10.6. So just like in the United States, where you've seen the big fall, we've seen some encouragement in the UK, but this is now a big fall in the Eurozone as well. It's going the right way. Look, we've got higher oil prices. Yes. So it's going to be more about the core going forward, because it's going to be hard for headline. But I mean, it's looking on the right way finally on inflation.
Okay. So to sum up then, we've got inflation is sort of moving in the right direction. Obviously, we've got central banks back again in November. So October is a relatively quiet month. We are seeing some positive Chinese data, particularly around travel within the country, air and rail traffic travel, which is, I think, from what I've seen, is up to, it's higher than it was in 2019. So it's really booming at the moment. And talking about the beer festival as well, there seems to be a greater desire for spending on experiences than spending on things. I guess maybe part of that is that people bought a lot of stuff during lockdown, whereas they couldn't spend on experiences.
Makes sense, Sarah. Makes sense.
They were shopping online. Okay. All right. Well, that's data. Gilts. And the fact that, well, I guess we should do a quick sort of primer on what we're talking about when we talk about gilts. The fact that they're CGT free and what you had to do with that.
So, should we explain what a gilt is?
Yeah,
because we have some super knowledgeable people. Thank you for people who got in touch, including some of very esteemed investment managers.
Who, I saw those comments.
Yeah, but for some of the, I'll give one example. So, what is a gilt? It's a government bond issued by the UK. Mm. And one example is the UK Treasury, 0.25% Jan 25.
Yeah.
So shall I break it down? UK Treasury, issued by the UK Treasury, government guaranteed, very safe. 0.25%, sounds crazy low. That's what the world used to be like, 21, 22.
I can remember when German bonds were minus.
We got a negative
yield on your German
bonds. We did have negative yields. So 0.25, that is the income you're going to get.
Yeah.
Just 0.25%.
And that's
Twice a year. So, you get taxed on that 0.25%.
Okay.
And Jan 25, what does that mean? In Jan 25, I think it's 31st of Jan 25, I'd have to check, but Jan 25, you get your money back, which is, you know, if you put, Sarah, if you raid your piggy bank and put £1 million in, you'll get £1 million back. It doesn't sound very enticing at 0.25%, but there's
not
a
really,
catch.
No.
Do you know what the price is today? 94.2.
I was going to say around 94.
I should have let you guess. Sometimes I want to put you out of your misery because, in case you say 100, you know, something like that. So 94.2. So this is the deal. So it's 94.2, but you get 100 back in about, what's that? It's about 15 months.
Yeah.
That gain, and this has been a matter of record since 1986, is tax free from 94.2 to 100.
Now, that's so if you bought trash. Them, that would be if you bought them on the secondary market, not if you
today.
Bought them when they were issued. If you bought them today on the secondary market, you'd be paying around 94% of the face value or the par.
Par is another word for 100, yeah. Mm. We've got to stop the terminology, you know, for our newer listeners who are newer to markets. But yeah, you're right. And But the good question is, why?
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Why?
It's crazy, isn't it? Tell you the reason is, Sarah, you own a 9-year gilt and a 10-year gilt.
Yes.
Right? So what I mean by that, so I've just given an example of 2025 gilt, so closer to 1 year. So you own a gilt maturing in 9 years or a gilt maturing in 10 years. Are they very different?
Well, I feel like this is a trick question. Apart from the fact that one takes longer to mature than the other one. No, surely not.
Correct. Correct. Your intuition is right. And this is the point. So if there was CGT on gilts and your 9-year gilt was at a loss, you just sell it, create a tax loss, and buy the 10-year. This is the key with gilts. Okay. Unlike stocks, let's say we're going to compare Apple and GameStop.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons.
Interesting
it's quite different from having a loss on Apple. Okay. There's not been many losses on Apple, but you've got a loss on Apple and you think, oh, I'll take my tax loss on Apple and I'll park it in GameStop for a while. Okay. I know sophisticated investors, I'm using a ridiculous example, but nevertheless, even very correlated equities can perform differently. Obviously, those are very, very different animals. So it's harder to do in stocks is what I'm saying. Not impossible, but harder to do in stocks. So anyway, what did I have to do with it?
Well, in a very small way, not really.
I joined Sun Alliance Investment Management as a graduate trainee, 1986.
You were still in short trousers then, weren't you, Alan?
Well, yeah, I might have been 21. God knows how old I was. I don't know, whatever how old I was. But anyway, but do you know what graduate training consists of in those days?
I dread to think.
Okay, I had a boss who was in charge of managing the gilts for Sun Alliance, and it was me. I sat next to him for 2 weeks. He went on holiday, training over. I'm not joking.
It's me. And there wasn't a market crash.
No, well, that came in 1987. No, so anyway, one of the jobs was to be fair, under supervision. One of the jobs was Alan. Look through and on certain portfolios, are there any losses on any of the gilts? If they are, come up with some interesting switches, just like I told you before, selling the 9-year to buy the 10-year. Because we can harvest all these tax losses, and therefore that will offset any gains we have on our equities. And therefore, why have gilts been CGT free since 1986? Because it was costing the inland revenue money. Because Alan Higgins, after 2 weeks trading, was doing tax loss trading, you know, under supervision, to be fair. My old colleagues at Sun Alliance, if you're listening. But still, that two-week training was all I needed. All this two-year stuff that these young graduates have. What's going on? 2 weeks, get straight into it.
So even if I bought a 10-year, a gilt that's going to mature in a year's time or however long, and I'm buying it at, say, 90%, and I sell it before maturity, and I sell it at 99% of face value, I'm not going to pay any CGT on that gain, I realise, in selling of that bond.
Correct. CGT free. And this business of all these bonds below 100, so I mentioned the 2025, because people think, oh, it's going to go away. How can it go away? It can only really go away if rates go back to 0 to 1, because this goes on and on and on. I just did a quick look at gilts with a coupon of less than 1%. So that's the interest you receive. And I'll just shout out some numbers, just get scale of, not numbers, years, to get scale of it. So I mentioned 2025, 2026, 28, 31, 29, I missed 29, 30, 33, 35, 46, 49, and even 2061 has a very low coupon gilt. So this is going to be with us for years to come.
Okay.
But could it change?
Well, I was going to say, could the government turn around and go, oh, hang on a minute, I think we need to reinstate this? Or is it just it costs them money to do it?
It used to cost them money. So like anything, you know, taxes do change. And, you know, maybe they're having a look at it. And maybe they will come up with something and say, no, we need to tax them. A couple of things of that. One, they need to issue gilts, and they do need the private sector a little bit, you know, to buy gilts. So there's a disincentive to buy gilts. So that'd be a bit of a surprise. But secondly, again, I go back to you. you own a 9-year and a 10-year gilt. Your 9-year gilt has a loss, sell it straight away. And by the 9.5, the 8.5, the 10-year gilt is homogeneous, is the technical term for the nature of the market. And there'll be a huge amount of tax loss selling. So I would be surprised, but I've been wrong before and we're wrong again. But yeah, they could look at it because it is massive competition for deposits. And you know, you can see how open we are here, because we obviously are a bank and we're very happy to take deposits. But obviously for taxpayers, this is super, super attractive. And interestingly, not that I recommend it, because I had a little read of it, even futures and options on gilts are tax-free, CGT-free.
Oh, really?
So for those out there who are really super-duper traders, I would say this is difficult, having tried it myself in terms of working with options and futures. If you do want to trade it, those are tax-free as well. So very, very unusual situation and super attractive for basically private client taxpayers.
And of course, we're not recommending that anyone goes out and buys gilts, but we're saying we're just basically making people aware who might not know. And I know you had a conversation with someone recently and who you would think would be fairly knowledgeable and wasn't aware of the CGT exemption status that gilts had.
Yeah, it was a whole table. So yeah, we were doing a dinner with a law firm. To be fair, that's fine. They're focusing on their law, busy people. But I just asked them if they knew about it, and not one of them did. To be fair, I should say they are new clients to this particular bank. So our coverage haven't really got round to hounding them and telling them about the opportunity to buy gilts or have a gilt portfolio with us. Yeah, it's less widely known, and you know, it's look, it's hard to make a return. You know, I'm a big advocate of equities for the long run, as you know, and I absolutely stand by equities for the long run. But for cash management, it's pretty hard to beat.
Okay, all right then. So interesting then. So for those that don't know, gilts, so bonds issued by the UK government, although actually, interestingly, both South Africa and India also issued gilts, I learned this week, but they are exempt from capital gains tax. Now, so we're not recommending it, but just there for information. Okay, then. Well, that's gilts. And then last but not least, we both went to see separately the latest sort of financial, well, it wasn't really a crisis, was it? But sort of financially inspired, market-inspired film, Dumb Money. Just perhaps let's start with, can you explain actually what the background story was to Dumb Money?
Okay, so the background story was the amazing meme stop rally highlighted on mainly GameStop and the whole story about that and how individuals seem to team up via Reddit, perfectly legal in terms of at least when Congress had a look at it, and basically drove up to, you might say, ridiculous levels, and it was ridiculous levels. So GameStop, for example, went from a low of less than a dollar to a high of 483 intraday.
Crikey. Is that classic momentum trading?
That's one way of looking at it. Yeah, they would call that momentum trading. Yes, that is momentum trading. But it's something that you really... I haven't seen anything like that in my investment career. Even we've covered previously the dot-com bubble. You know, this was of a different scale. Maybe Tulip Mania might have been like this. I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't know. What do you think of the film?
Well, I was going to say, before we get onto that, I was going to say, for this to happen, you probably need to have social media, don't you? Without social media, I don't know that something like GameStop would happen, because you need, it's driven by, because he was presenting, what was his name, Keith Gill, his other name we won't use, because this is a, you know, this is, we might have children listening to this, but you know, what was he, Roaring Kitty or whatever, you know, he was on YouTube talking about how he liked a particular stock, and then it was Reddit boards and chat boards and various things. So you need social media perhaps to drive this kind of thing. What did I think about it? It was, I thought it's quite entertaining. It was quite sort of, you know, you're on the edge of your seat. I mean, you know what happens, but it is quite sort of exciting watching those, all these sort of investors, these little retail investors, where the sort of expression dumb money comes from, which is a bit derogatory, but watching them sort of seeing their investment grow and then not knowing what Keith was doing. Was he holding? Was he selling? And they were trying to decide what they were going to do. It was quite sort of tense. It was sort of, I thought it was entertaining, but I wonder how, what perhaps, was it Gabe Plotkin and Kenneth Griffin feel about it? I do believe Kenneth Griffin, as solicitors, have sent a letter. They're not very happy with the way that he was portrayed in the film to the producers.
Yeah, so let's cover those two. So Ken Griffin, absolutely legendary investor. I did cover, you know, how he suffered in the 08-09 financial crisis like many. And this is really his securities operation that does most of the trading for Robin Hood, which featured. I didn't think he came out too bad, but who came out really bad was Gabe, the other hedge fund manager, who got absolutely crucified, which comes back to what I want to talk about is the lessons. So I've ordered the book from Victor Hagani. So the guy who wrote the book, Victor Hagani, he suffered by losing most of his wealth in long-term capital, which is the 25-year anniversary.
Which we talked about on last week's Need to Know.
We covered it last week. The 25-year anniversary, he lost most of his wealth, not all of it, through that. And so I'll come back to dumb money, but just on long-term capital, they inappropriately sized something which they consider to be close to risk-free. So arbitrage. So at its simplest form, you know I mentioned a 9-year and a 10-year gilt.
Yes.
Before. Say the 10-year gilt is popular, but the 9-year gilt is less popular, just slightly cheaper, cheaper.
So you've got a difference in yield. The less popular one has got a better yield than the more popular one.
So they would have buckets of 9-year, technical term, buckets of 9-year gilts hedged by buckets of 10-year gilts.
Right.
As a hedge position, supposedly low risk in ridiculously big size. Nothing wrong with that trade, but long-term capital fact did it in far too big a size with leverage and absolutely collapsed. And so sizing really, really is important, because there's also a few sad stories for people who bought into GameStop too late, because actually just the numbers, so what people want to know. GameStop hit an intraday high of 483. Before the fatal news about Robin Hood no longer taking orders. It's now 17. So you can see there's an awful lot of losers, and some of the losers were featured, were a bit of a sad story, weren't they?
They were.
There were some winners. There were some winners, which apparently Keith was a winner.
Yeah.
But the biggest loser with this, the hedge fund.
I was going to say, Keith has actually completely disappeared now, hasn't he? We don't know where he is. He's kind of hidden himself away.
Now, look, so lessons, you know, people who had virtually 100% of their net worth in this, some people made out well. Keith seemed to, we don't know, but they gave examples of nurses and other people like that who lost absolute fortune from buying too late. Mm. And then it comes back to the professional, and this is where it's really made an impact in the professionally managed area, especially in hedge funds, is Gabe got caught out in a short squeeze, which basically finished his fund.
So explain how that, what is a short squeeze for those that don't know?
Okay, so the way to imagine this, Sarah, you and I are managing a 100 million fund, hedge fund, right?
Yeah.
We put 5% into GameStop to buy, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, and we stupidly buy it at 483, okay?
Okay.
Because we're a momentum hedge fund. We buy it at 483. It finishes at 17, you know, now. It's now trading at 17. Mm. So we've lost nearly everything. We've lost nearly all of 5%. But that's all we've lost. And by the way, that's not good. And that goes to show, for individual stocks, even when you buy stocks, 5% is too big a position. Okay? Because 5% is a big hit to wealth. And these things happen. Okay, GameStop is an exaggeration. But it's much worse when you're a hedge fund doing short selling.
Okay, to
explain it. Firstly, okay, we've got a $100 million fund again. I'm not saying he did it in this size, but just to give an example of how it explodes up to you. We short sell GameStop in 5%. Now, to short sell, we have to borrow the stock from a prime broker.
Yeah.
We sell it into the market. And by the way, it's quite expensive sometimes to borrow some of these stocks. We sell it into the market, and it goes to, let's just say, quickly. Okay, so we've lost 45%, $45 million, right?
Okay.
Because we sold something at five, we're buying it back at 50.
Yeah, because we have to cover that short position.
We have to cover short. We have to cover it. So the contrast between long and short. The example, when we bought at the top, we've lost 5%. Not great. To be a short seller without good discipline or something that just explodes in your face, then he's down 45%. Now, the short squeeze refers to the fact that what Keith was seen to be really good at is that he looked at stocks that were heavily shorted by people like Gabe, and therefore thought, wow, if this company could potentially turn around, which he seemed to generally believe GameStop could be, then Gabe and others will have to buy it back and they'll drive the price upwards. And that's basically exactly what happened. And I think his fund did fall 50-odd%, of which GameStop was the main contributor. And by the way, to be fair to Gabe, he was, his track record previously was exemplary, absolutely stellar. But just goes to show how hard it is in this business. And so it's really hard.
So his mistake was that he put too much into shorting GameStop, and it was too big a chunk of his fund. And he got caught out then when there was that short squeeze.
Exactly. And I'm not saying the amount is 5%, but you can see even 1-2%.
Mm.
And it is difficult. And it's changed. It really has changed the hedge fund world in terms of how they look at shorting this episode. How dangerous is. And by the way, I know of other examples of really smart people who've tried to short Tesla from our friend Elon Musk.
Crikey.
Not as dramatic as GameStop, but again, had to cover, lost multiples and multiples, and just ended their fund and even ended their career. So, look, I was a hedge fund manager, apart from working at Sun Alliance. After my 2-week training, I did become a hedge fund manager for 2 years, and at a multi-strat firm. So I was a bit hidden because I was at a multi-strategy firm. Okay. So it was, you know, you don't have quite so much exposure, but nevertheless, it is ridiculously hard to make steady, especially to make steady returns. There's different types of hedge funds that might just say, we're buying the best 20 equities and we're superb at them, and there's plenty of those. And or I'm buying the best distressed debt that's near default. You know, all of these are difficult, but to try and make steady returns from shorting, I tried it as part of a multi-strategy team. And whilst, you know, I'm pleased to say we made solid returns, we as a whole group for our clients overall, it was ridiculously hard, really hard.
So what happened to Gabe Plotkin in the end? Did he come back with another fund, or did he disappear?
You know what? I'm going to have a check. As far as I know, he's disappeared. It's pretty hard to come back.
Yeah.
Maybe he's managing his own money right now. I must admit, I did feel uncomfortable as a lover of tennis to see it featured in the film how he wanted to tear down a house just to build a tennis court. I thought, a bit of me thought, yeah, that's quite reasonable.
So it's sort of summary then, this is sort of tying in a little bit dumb money and the research that you've read. If you're a fund that's going to short something or short a stock, for example, you can do it, but you've got to be careful. You've got to exercise caution with how much you put into that short. If it's too big a chunk of your fund, then if you get it wrong, it could be the end of it could be game over for your fund, essentially.
I think that's right. And there's a wider issue about sizing. I think after I've read the book, I'll come back to it in more detail. But going back to 08-09, which we covered, what killed a lot of investors in 08-09 was not the idea of buying those subprime CDOs. Nothing wrong with that idea. The problem was, they're AAA. I can have huge amounts of them.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'm sorry to say, the German banks were big in this, as was AIG, as was others, you know, very many. And it's kind of a bit under the radar how you size a position in investments. We don't talk about it very much, do we?
No, we don't
talk about it, but it's absolutely crucial.
We talk about diversification all the time, but we don't then look beneath that to see, okay, well, when you diversify, how much percentage do you allocate to this and to this and to this? And that's obviously just as important.
It is, it is. But so that's it. Yeah, I recommend the film. Also, intriguingly, you know, can't get crypto out of it, produced by the Winklevoss twins.
Yes.
From
yes,
Facebook.
Exactly, because it's actually the chap who wrote the book, who's, I'm now probably going to mispronounce his name, Ben Metzrich. He also wrote the book about Facebook as well. So his book was called The Antisocial Network, which is the one about the GameStop. But he wrote The Accidental Billionaires that went on to be made into The Social Network.
The Accidental Billionaires. Isn't that my book? That's
the book about the, I'm assuming that's about the Winklevoss twins.
Okay, fair enough. My book is The Missing Billionaires by Hagami. Yes. In defense, I haven't received it yet. I couldn't get it from Amazon. I had to go on eBay to buy it.
Really?
Even a hard copy. I'm that desperate to read it. So, my book is a bit different. And he's talking about the fact that actually, interestingly, which is, you know, closer to us, is that many previous billionaire families aren't able to keep their wealth because of inappropriate sized investments. But he also comes, so it's, I think it's going to be a very interesting book to read.
Yeah.
Full of interesting stories. So we'll come to that.
Okay. Final thoughts then on dumb money from an expert perspective. Do you think it was an accurate representation?
Yeah, absolutely. I think even more accurate than The Big Short, actually. Yeah, very accurate. Mm. A bit easier to understand because once you get your head around being short,
you can
see the losses and you can see the gains. Mm. And it was just kind of almost one equity. But yeah, and enjoyable. No major stars in the film, but, you know, some nice little bits in there and quite human. But
could
some
we
very
get
sad stories as well.
Some very sad stories. Could we see another GameStop?
I've got to say yes, because you mentioned it to start social media. You've got to say yes. I mean, yeah, people have short memories. Whether I'll be working, I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
But
you just need
it may take 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. You need another sort of unloved stock that maybe somebody, you know, rallies behind on social media, gets that momentum going. Everybody, you know, it's us. It's sort of David and Goliath, isn't it? So it could happen again.
It could, yeah. And I think that's likely, but the memories are a bit fresh now.
Okay, all right. Well, we look forward to Missing Billionaires, that book review, when you finally get a hold of a copy of that. Thank you very much, Alan. A reminder that the views expressed in this podcast are not intended to constitute investment or, for that matter, tax advice, are accurate at the time of recording and are subject to change. Don't forget to check out the podcast page on Cootes.com. And if you're not already, please subscribe and leave reviews for the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your access need to know. Now, I'm not here next week. I'm actually taking a week's holiday. So I'm leaving Alan in Ben Allen's capable hands. Now, if you've been listening to Need to Know for a while, you'll know Ben Allen. He's very, very good. I hope he's not going to be too good because he might do me out of a job. But anyway, Ben Allen will be sitting in for me next week with Alan Higgins, trying to keep him under control. Until I'm back in 2 weeks' time or until next week's Need to Know, bye for now.